Chapter 12. A penultimate chapter. George Melly did a series of late-night chat shows for Granada Television, and his idea was to have guests who were really friends, so that there would be no need for a clipboard full of questions prepared by researchers, just George and his guest. He kindly invited me onto the programme. I remember the pre-show hospitality was particularly lavish, and the interview suitably outrageous. I finished up trying to train the audience to play shitties. Some weeks later, a letter arrived at the Python office via the BBC Television Centre. This was from an extremely angry lady who said that someone from Monty Python, who had not had the courage to give his name, I didn't need to, George had introduced me, and there it was in the closing credits, had appeared on the George Melly programme and had admitted to being homosexual. Her handwriting became visibly angrier as she went on to say that persons like that should not be allowed to live and should suffer eternal torment in the fires of hell and were an abomination. There was much more self-righteous invective, promising more fire and brimstone, followed up by some 20 pages of prayers which, if they were repeated by the offender twice daily, would place him in some kind of purgatory instead. Eric Idle had a marvellous idea and wrote back to the lady saying that we found out which one it was, and we've killed him. Curiously enough, we did the next TV series without John Cleese. I wonder what she thought. Several years earlier, there was a charity football match. M. Python and some others were playing the rest of the world. I didn't want to get involved with actually playing, and so did my charitable bit by turning up as the colonel and marching up and down the field barking orders, lying in the goal mouth and just generally making a nuisance of myself. I find football an entirely tedious game anyway. Someone I didn't know till then, he was called Keith Moon, also thought that the game needed a bit more life, and drove a car onto the pitch, grabbed the ball, and scored. The game became suitably muddled after that, and we all went to the clubhouse for drinkies. Keith and I seemed to have some kind of instant rapport, and certainly we both liked drink. We played an old St. Swithin's game called Shitties, in which teams compete in trying to deposit 3 coins held between the buttocks into a pint pot placed 10 feet away from the starting line. A few more drinks, and then back to Keith's place. An amazing construction of plate glass and concrete with octophonic sound in every room, all playing different tracks. A howling dog and a nearly ex-wife locked in a broom cupboard. Here we had more drinks and apologised for having driven over Keith's chauffeur's hat. He reminisced gleefully about a few recent outrages and outlined a change of policy. Instead of destroying repellent hotel rooms, he had decided on a more constructive approach. Every visitor should smuggle in a suitcase full of building materials so that he could build some annoyingly permanent memento like a brick dog kennel in the middle of the room. I left at about 3 or 4 in the morning, Keith providing me with a bottle of scotch for the long journey from Chertsey. Very considerate. I would have done the same for him, and I have. The next time I remember meeting Keith was after a concert at the Sundown in Edmonton, London. Amazing. The balcony oscillated fully 6 inches in the middle, and the walls could be seen vibrating with the wonderful noise of The Who. I found I could actually understand the words if I put my fingers in my ears. I went round backstage afterwards to congratulate Keith. Great, loved it, I said. I could hear some of the words with my fingers in my ears. Keith laughed, and a diminutive grey-haired old lady said, "Shall I hit him, Keith, or will you?" Keith said, "Oh, you do it." She then swiftly lifted one of her little legs and kicked me in the balls. Fortunately, she just missed these sensitive parts, and I said magnanimously, "Go on, have another go," expecting her to give up. But she didn't, and clipped the lower bit of my left testicle. "Wah!" I went. Keith apologised for his mother-in-law's behaviour and suggested we should go for a drink. For once, I didn't feel like a drink and left, promising to see him again as soon as I felt better. The next time I saw Keith was at the Londonderry Hotel, the only hotel in London which would accept him, and even then his penthouse suite was registered under the name of Rupert Wilde. I called at the Londonderry and asked for Mr. Wilde's suite. It was on the top floor, the 11th, I think, and I arrived to find Keith and a few assorted girls, but no gin and tonic. I filled in with a beer or two while we waited for the gin Keith had immediately ordered from room service on my arrival. 15 minutes later, still no sign of gin. Keith rang room service to tell them that if the gin didn't arrive within the next 5 minutes, their television set would arrive on the pavement. Keith became impatient and disappeared out of the window. I realised that this itself was extraordinary more than 10 floors up. I looked out of the window expecting to see a balcony, but no, there was no balcony, and no Keith, only a 4-inch-wide ledge extending round the building. I wouldn't have gone out there, but then I wasn't Keith. I sat back and waited, sipping at a beer. Then Keith reappeared through the window, carrying a bottle of Beefeater gin, which he plonked on the table, saying, "There you are, Graham." He had made his way along the ledge and broken into the next-door penthouse suite and stolen the bottle from their drinks cabinet. Keith was never dull. Nobody could ever accuse him of that. And whenever the two of us arrived together in his old local, or my current one, the Angel, there was an air of expectancy. Something was about to happen. He was never predictable, and arrived at the pub one evening while a quiet charity raffle of a cake and a basket of fruit was in progress for Hornsey handicapped children. The enthusiastic bidding was flagging at £1.50 for the fruit. Keith immediately put in a bid of £45 and startled everyone by paying another £50 for the cake. And the people there who had been expecting trouble at the sight of him had to revise their opinions. We then went back to my place for a few drinkies, and a friend of mine from the pub, Dennis, found a naughty lady of the night, and with the aid of Keith's white Rolls-Royce Phantom, brought her to the house. At the point where Keith seemed to be about to eat a butterfly she had tattooed near to her naughty bits, I suddenly decided that it was Isaac's time, a mountaineer's primitive way of ejecting unwanted callers, and that everyone should leave. Keith later correctly ascribed this to jealousy, in that everything would have been fine if a suitable young man had been found as well. The Who were doing 3 charity Christmas concerts at the Hammersmith Odeon. Keith asked me if I would help out by filling in between acts. I said yes, and prepared a little bit of nonsense to perform, and had a ridiculous song, Yardy Buckety, written out on a sheet to be lowered down so that the audience could get to sing, relieving some of my burden. No one had come to the theatre to hear my attempts at humour. They wanted The Who. I had a difficult time and gave up in mid-monologue and cut to the end of the song and got off. Keith said, "You were lousy and drunk." I agreed. I had been lousy, but the drunkenness was immaterial. I told him not to worry, and now that I'd got the audience sussed, I'd have something better worked out for the next 2 nights. The next night, I arranged for my microphone to be put through the same amplification system as The Who, and walked out onto the stage and asked the audience for 10 minutes of abuse. They started shouting a few obscenities. Then, through the full amplification, I told them that this was not good enough. I meant real abuse. That was rotten, feeble. I shouted over their now mounting yells of shithead, cunt, etc., and then stood back and looked at my wristwatch, encouraging them occasionally, if their abuse showed any sign of waning in intensity. After 10 minutes was up, I got them to sing the song, and everyone was in the right mood for The Who. I came off stage, and there was Keith grinning. "Fucking great," he said. The third night was no problem either. The most frightening appearance I've ever made was doing a similar job filling in between acts for Pink Floyd and their Nebworth outdoor concert. Walking up onto that stage alone to face 90,000 people was alarming. I include this as an example of the self-aggrandizement posing as humility common to all autobiographies. The film Monty Python and the Holy Grail made a lot of money for me, and for me it was a lot. Unfortunately, the tax people demanded 83% of this, but having a little left, I decided to invest it in something I knew about. Some years before, Bernard McKenna had written a half-hour TV play for Ronnie Barker called The Odd Job. I liked this and thought that it would form the basis for a very funny film, the idea being that a man who had found himself incapable of committing suicide hires an odd job man to do the job for him. Knowing his own weakness, he tells the man not to take any notice should he appear to change his mind or make any attempt to preserve his life. Just bump him off. The odd job man leaves. The central character's reasons for wanting to commit suicide then disappear, with the reappearance of a forgiving wife. But now there is a man out there with a contract on him, whom he has no way of contacting, and who will take no notice of him even if he did. Keith, I thought, would make an excellent odd job man. I commissioned a script from Bernard, and the process of film production began. Eventually, I had a script that I was happy with. Keith and I were to play the leads, and I found sufficient financial backing, about £500,000. The production was on. Now, Keith had a problem with alcohol, just as I had. Indeed, I first began to realise how ill I was becoming, having sat next to Keith's bedside on the occasions when he was suffering, and I mean suffering, from withdrawal symptoms. He had hallucinated that he was losing weight to the extent that he would shortly no longer exist, and had to keep weighing himself for reassurance. He also thought the SAS were after him, and had tied him to the bed for one entire night, with wire electrodes either side of his testicles, so that if he shook or moved at all, the shock would be very nasty indeed. It's difficult to remain motionless when you have DTs. This was an horrific experience for him. 2 weeks away from shooting, Keith was in hospital drying out to get fit, ready for the filming. Unfortunately, the director I'd engaged, Cliff Owen, had broken his thigh a week earlier, and we now had a new director, Peter Medak. Feeling lucky to find a director who would be willing to take on the task at such short notice, I took Peter to see Keith in hospital, where we did a little read-through of a couple of scenes. We left the hospital. Peter Medak became convinced that my best friend was not the right person for the job. I felt he was wrong, but there was little I could do about it. My executive producers, they provided a lot of the actual cash, preferred to take Peter's judgment on this issue, despite vigorous protestation from me directly to Peter's main ally in this, a chap called Steve O'Rourke, manager of the Pink Floyd, to whom I said that I had only begun to be interested in this project from the start because this was exactly the right role for Keith, and that without him the film would just become another British B-feature or worse. Short of cancelling filming altogether, there was nothing I could do. My producers, executive producers, and even author Bernard were all expressing doubts as to Keith's ability. In part, they were worried, I suppose, about his drinking, but damn it, they were wrong. I knew the two of us could see it through. By this time, I'd been off alcohol for 3 months. I had a sleepless night. I knew how much Keith was looking forward to the part in the film. I knew that I was right, and they were wrong. But should I just wave goodbye to £50,000 I'd already spent on making the film, or take a chance on it making money? I chose the latter, and still wish I hadn't. Keith was very understanding about it, but I knew how much it must have hurt him. At the same time, EMI had just backed out of their deal with Python about providing $4 million for the Life of Brian production. Lord Delfont himself gave us the chop, above the heads of the chief of EMI production, who had agreed the terms. Keith set about vigorously trying to raise the money for us to save this venture and would have succeeded in time, but George Harrison made an extremely courageous offer which was eagerly accepted by us and the film was on again. Keith was going to play the part of one of the Blood and Thunder prophets in that, and when I met him a week before we went to start shooting in Tunisia, he seemed to be looking forward to it all very much. He was still not drinking and had, it seemed, beaten the bottle. But on September the 7th, 1978, he died, having drunk a quantity of wine, some brandy, and taken some heminevrin pills, a drug sometimes used to avert the foulest horrors of alcohol withdrawal. A combination which was deadly. I didn't know how to react. The loss was too appalling to comprehend, but it left me determined to make sure that his spirit, his vision of right and wrong, his energy, would not die with him. Keith was kindness itself and never harmed anyone in his escapades, which certainly brightened up many lives, just because there was someone around who was reckless enough to say, "Stuff the lot of you," and drive his Rolls-Royce into a swimming pool, or blow the door off a hotel bedroom with dynamite because a pompous hotel manager complained about his cassette recorder making a noise in the lobby. The amazed manager, staring at the smoking doorway as Keith pointed at his cassette still playing, was told, "That is noise, mate. This is The Who." Keith is one person I know I'll see again. Now, as luck and Captain W.E. Johns would have it, everything went Air Force blue with flashes of gold. We hurtled towards the safe pericentre of the black hole of Orion, employing occasional plasma ramjet thrusts to avoid a clutch of indescribable singularities, arriving light years away, but simultaneously in Los Angeles 2 years later. I had slipped into a state of inertia. All further activity seemed pointless. I had fallen foul of one of my own footnotes. For months now, I'd been suffering from this ill-defined mental malaise. Nothing seemed real anymore. Was this just the effect of living in Los Angeles, in which case I should leave immediately, or was there some deeper psychopathology? I called Dr. Wanacross to examine me. As we sipped our apricot Shastas, we chatted amiably about how it was now 2 years since our encounter in Chapter Naught. He was pleased that I had successfully kicked the habit of 23/37ths of a lifetime, but again gave analytical flummery the elbow and said, "Do you realise that in the 10 minutes I've been here you've dropped 17 famous names?" "Have I?" I said. "I didn't intend to. It's just that I happen to know these people. They're friends of mine. They live here." "I want you to repeat what you've just said to yourself and think about it as a medical man." "You mean I've got..." My head reeled as the grim reality struck me like a blow on the head from a copy of Cecil and Loeb. Yes, Nivenism, he said. It's a common enough complication of angelitis, a similar disease to that described by Freud as the Frank Harris syndrome, an endemic autobiographical complaint. What should I do, move to Finland? No, you must face the problem. There is no known treatment, you'll just have to sweat it out. Isn't there anything I can do to speed up my recovery? There is, but it isn't going to be pleasant, I'm afraid. Revulsion therapy. I'm going to prescribe to you an intensive course of Hollywood parties. It's your only hope.